Abraham Lincoln, Chapter 6, The Lincoln-Douglas Debates. You will remember that when Lincoln returned to his home in Springfield after his term in Congress was over, he determined to give up politics and devote his entire energy to the study of law. At that time, he believed that he would never enter the political field again, but only 5 years passed before a public event so aroused him that he changed his mind. This was the repeal of the Missouri Compromise in 1854. It took such a hold upon his feelings that he could scarcely talk about anything else. We shall better understand why he was so disturbed over this repeal if we briefly review the slavery troubles that were straining the relations between the North and the South. Before the purchase of the Louisiana Territory, which, as you know, meant nearly everything west of the Mississippi, from Arkansas to Canada, and west to Utah and Idaho, all the states north of Mason and Dixon's line and the Ohio River were free states, while the other states, those south of that line, were slave states. This was not according to any law of the nation, but on account of the nature of the soil and climate. With the purchase of Louisiana, however, many new states would, in time, be added to the Union, and the question of how many should be slave and how many should be free had to be settled, because the vast new profits from raising cotton had made the South eager to extend slave territory, and the feeling against slavery was growing strong in the North. This question the Missouri Compromise was supposed to decide. It provided that Missouri should come into the Union as a slave state, but that all the remaining territory in the Louisiana Purchase, which lay west and north of Missouri, should be forever free. There was no further serious trouble over slavery in new states until the end of the Mexican War. Then, by the Compromise of 1850, it was provided that California should come into the Union as a free state, and that in all the rest of the territory acquired from Mexico, that is, what were then the territories of Utah and New Mexico, the people should decide for themselves whether or not they would have slavery. Of course, in a compromise, a sort of halfway meeting, neither side gets everything it wishes. Each has to give up something to the other. Yet when the Compromise of 1850 was agreed upon, both Northern and Southern political leaders honestly believed that the slavery controversy was settled for all time. But it was not. In 1854, under the able leadership of Senator Stephen A. Douglas of Illinois, another bill, the Kansas-Nebraska Bill, was passed. This provided that in the territory lying north and west of Missouri, that territory in the Louisiana Purchase, which by the Missouri Compromise was made forever free, the people should decide for themselves whether or not they would have slavery. This bill thrust aside, or repealed, the Missouri Compromise and put in its place the right of popular sovereignty, as Douglas called it. This disregard of the Missouri Compromise aroused Lincoln as perhaps nothing has ever aroused him before. It was a great wrong, he believed, and the thought haunted him day and night. It seemed to take complete possession of him. All his life he had believed that slavery was wrong, because he believed no man had a right to own another. Yet he had no idea of interfering with slavery in the states that already had it, for in all those states any man had just as firm a legal right, according to the Constitution of the United States, to own slaves as he had to own houses and land, or any other kind of property. But Lincoln was strongly, even bitterly, opposed to the extension of slavery into new states. Moreover, quite apart from the human injustice and wrong of slavery, was the violation of his sense of the uprightness of law, for he regarded slavery compromises, like the Missouri Compromise, just as morally binding as the Constitution itself, and considered that, in thrusting it aside, the framers of the Kansas-Nebraska Bill were breaking the law of the nation. He therefore determined to use all the powers of his being to get the law restored and to prevent Kansas from coming into the Union as a slave state. So it was the Kansas-Nebraska Bill, repealing the Missouri Compromise, that called Abraham Lincoln back into politics and summoned him to take up his great life mission, which involved a resolute and unwavering opposition to the extension of slavery. It was as if a higher power said to him, "This is your work. Do it, no matter what may be the cost to you in time, strength, or political advancement." Opposition to the extension of slavery was the one fundamental issue upon which the Republican Party was built. Lincoln was so strongly in sympathy with this doctrine that, although up to this time he had been a Whig, he joined the Republican Party, which in 1856 it was organized in the state of Illinois at a convention held in Bloomington. After this convention had adopted a platform, elected delegates to the Republican National Convention, and nominated state officers, it called upon certain men present for speeches. None of them seemed to make much impression. But finally, the audience shouted, "Lincoln! Lincoln!" again and again. Slowly, his tall form rose in the back part of the room and moved forward to the platform. His countenance seemed to be burdened by a great weight. It was plain that he thought of this as a crisis in his life, a great opportunity. It was the moment when he was about to announce himself as no longer a Whig, but from that time on, a Republican. As he turned to look at his eager listeners, his face changed. A great passion laid hold upon him, and he seemed to grow in stature. At first he talked slowly, even haltingly, but in a little while, when deep emotion swayed him, he spoke with greater force. His eyes blazed with excitement, his face became pale, and his voice was vibrant with deep feeling. As he grew more and more intense, his audience started from their seats with white faces and quivering lips moving toward the speaker. Men and women cheered and cried at the same time. In a little while, all present seemed to feel and think and will as one man, and Lincoln had made them Republicans not only in name, but also in spirit. "The conclusion of all is," said Lincoln in his closing words, "that we must restore the Missouri Compromise. We must highly resolve that Kansas must be free." The greatest speech ever made in Illinois, and it puts Lincoln on the track for the presidency, was the comment made by many enthusiastic Republicans present. Many newspaper men who came in to make reports of the speeches were held so spellbound that they put their pens and pencils aside. "I attended for about 15 minutes," says Mr. Herndon, Lincoln's law partner, "as it was usual with me to make notes, but at the end of that time, I threw pen and paper away and lived only in the inspiration of the hour." It required courage for Abraham Lincoln to make this speech, for in doing so he was not only defending an unpopular cause, but he was giving up his place in an old and well-grounded political party to join a new and unpopular one. Yet it set him apart as the right man for leadership of the Republican Party in Illinois, for it gave unmistakable evidence of his fearless spirit and of his stubborn resolve to fight to the bitter end in the cause of righteousness, justice, and humanity. He believed in his cause, and he believed in God, so he took up the fight. Men soon began to follow him with admiration and enthusiasm. Day by day, slowly but steadily, he won others to his way of thinking until, 2 years after his eloquent speech before the Bloomington Convention, he had become so influential in his party that his nomination for the United States Senate in the approaching Republican Convention of the state of Illinois seemed to be a certainty. As the day drew near for this convention to meet, June 16, 1858, Lincoln was observed from time to time to make notes on such scraps of papers and old envelopes as happened to be convenient, and to put them in the crown of his hat. He sought no one's advice, nor confided in anyone, until the day before the convention, when, having his speech well thought out, he took it to a number of his friends. The part of it which was likely to receive most criticism was as follows: "A house divided against itself cannot stand. I believe this government cannot endure permanently half slave and half free. I do not expect the Union to be dissolved. I do not expect the House to fall, but I do expect it will cease to be divided. It will become all one thing or all the other. Either the opponents of slavery will arrest the further spread of it and place it where the public mind can rest in the belief that it is in the course of ultimate extinction, or its advocates will push it forward until it shall become alike lawful in all states, old as well as new, north as well as south. When he read these words to his friends, only one of them, Herndon, his partner, approved. Herndon said, "Lincoln, deliver that speech as read, and it will make you president." All the others strongly denounced it as unwise, foolish, and inviting disaster. But Lincoln said, "Friends, this thing has been retarded long enough. The time has come when these sentiments should be uttered. And if it is decreed that I should go down because of this speech, then let me go down linked with the truth. Let me die in the advocacy of what is just and right." The next day he made the speech without the change of a single word, and to one critic he said later, "If I had to draw a pen across my record and erase my whole life from sight, but had one poor gift or choice left as to what I should say from the wreck, I should choose that speech and leave it to the world unerased." Douglas, in his public speeches, made a strong point of the House divided against itself part of Lincoln's speech. He said, "It is sectional, and it proves that Lincoln is an abolitionist." This was giving a wrong impression, for abolitionists believed in doing away with slavery in all the states, and that was quite a different matter from what Lincoln was trying to have done, which was to restrict it to the states in which it already existed. Douglas kept criticizing Lincoln's position without directly meeting his arguments until, at the end of a month, Lincoln resolved to make him face the issue squarely. So he challenged the senator to a series of debates. Douglas accepted the challenge, and it was arranged to hold 7 joint debates in various parts of the state. The 2 debaters were very different in appearance and training, and to the minds of most people, quite unequal, Douglas appearing to be much the superior of the 2. Although he was then only 45 years old, he was the most brilliant leader in the Democratic Party. His rise in the political world had caught public attention. When only 28, he had filled a place on the bench of the state Supreme Court. At 31, he had been a member of Congress, and for 11 years he had been in the United States Senate, where he held a place of national prominence. After the deaths of Henry Clay, Daniel Webster, and John C. Calhoun, he was the member most powerful in debate, and had been at least a match for the 3 most distinguished senators, Charles Sumner, William H. Seward, and Salmon P. Chase. He was short in stature, hardly 5 feet 4 inches tall, but his broad shoulders, his massive and majestic head, and his deep, powerful voice helped to make him a most impressive speaker. Besides, he was not only well-dressed and prosperous-looking, but he appeared to be perfectly at home on the public platform, where his personal magnetism and unusual gifts of oratory gave him great power over his audience. Lincoln's position, in contrast, was almost pathetic. To be sure, he had served 8 years in the state legislature and 1 term in Congress, but at the end of this term his record had been accounted so nearly a failure that, as already noted, he had retired from public life. Even now, at the age of 49, he was a country lawyer, with no following outside of his own state. His greatest source of strength was the truth which he wished to present, and this, of course, did not appear at the outset. So, as he rose before an audience, they saw only a tall, gaunt figure, towering 6 feet 4 inches in height, clothed in garments that hung loosely upon his ill-jointed frame. When he began to speak, his shoulders drooped as if he were weak and uncertain of himself. His high, tenor voice in moments of excitement was shrill and piercing, but there was in his sad face a sincerity, in his manner a modesty, and in his words a simplicity, which spoke directly to the heart and gave a convincing quality to his words. Moreover, when swayed by deep emotion, his voice became soft and musical, and people listened to him with breathless interest. Lincoln realized quite as completely as anyone could the striking contrast between himself and his powerful opponent. "With me," he said in melancholy tones, when he was comparing his own career with that of Douglas, "the race of ambition has been a failure, a flat failure. With him it has been one of splendid success." But notwithstanding this feeling, he entered upon the great contest with unflinching courage, with the assurance that, however weak he might be in himself, his purpose was upright and his cause was just. Immense crowds swarmed to these meetings. Men, women, and children came from long distances, in wagons, in carriages, on horseback, and afoot. Many brought food, and some brought bedding also. At night they encamped in the fields and groves surrounding the town where the meeting was held, till the campfire suggested the gathering of an army. Before the second debate, Lincoln called some of his political friends together and asked their advice about some questions which he thought of putting to Douglas. One of these was as follows: "Can the people of a United States territory in any lawful way exclude slavery from its limits prior to the formation of a state constitution?" This was a trying question, for if Douglas answered no, the North would not like it. If he said yes, the South would be displeased. Most of Lincoln's friends advised him not to ask the question. They said, "If you do, you will make a serious mistake. If Douglas says yes, you will lose the senatorship." Lincoln, with great confidence, responded, "I am after larger game. If Douglas answers this question in such a way as to win the senatorship, he will lose the presidency in 1860, and that battle is worth 100 of this." The next day, Lincoln's friends noted that he mounted the platform with a firmer step and a more confident manner than he had done at the time of the first debate. Moreover, he asked the question just as he had presented it to them in the first place. Douglas's answer was, "The people of a territory can, by unfriendly legislation, exclude slavery from a territory before the formation of a state constitution." This answer reassured the North and helped Douglas to win the senatorship. But when the knowledge of it reached the people of the South, they were indignant. They declared that Douglas had betrayed them and that he had repudiated the Dred Scott decision. The Dred Scott decision, as you should know, had been given out in 1857 by the Supreme Court. It declared that a Negro was not a citizen and that slave owners had a right to take their slaves into a territory and hold them there as slaves, just as they had to hold them in a slave state. In other words, masters might take their slaves to any part of the Union just as they or anybody else might take cattle, horses, or any other kind of personal property. Lincoln showed the contradictory nature of Douglas's position on the use of unfriendly legislation to shut slavery out of a territory where, by the Dred Scott decision, it had a right to be, in the following words: "The judge holds that a thing may be lawfully driven away from a place where it has a lawful right to be." At the last of the debates, Lincoln uttered, in closing, these impressive words: "Is slavery wrong? That is the real issue. That is the issue that will continue in this country when these poor tongues of Judge Douglas and myself shall be silent. It is the eternal struggle between these two principles, right and wrong, throughout the world." While these debates were going on, both Lincoln and Douglas had to endure considerable hardship in their long journeyings. But Douglas's movements were something like a triumphal procession. Most of the time he traveled in the luxurious private car of George B. McClellan, vice president of the Illinois Central Railroad Company. For this company, the real terminus of the railroad being at New Orleans and much of its business coming from the South, was opposed to the Republican Party. A brass band traveled with him, and attached to his car was a platform which carried a cannon. On the arrival of Douglas's train in a town where debate was to be held, there was fired a salute of 32 guns, one for each of the 32 states. Then, riding in a handsome equipage and escorted by his brass band, Douglas made his way to the tavern, his admirers greeting him with enthusiasm along the way. Much of the time, Mrs. Douglas, a woman of fine presence and of gracious manner, accompanied her husband and exercised no small influence in his favor. In striking contrast to this method of travel, Lincoln occupied a half seat in an ordinary coach, or if there was no coach, rode in a freight car, although on some occasions he had to travel during the night. He had not an independent fortune like Douglas, but was a poor man, and therefore had to be careful about the expenditure of money. The only time when he traveled in state was when he went to some out-of-the-way place, not on the railroad, to make a speech between debates. On such an occasion, a distinguished citizen would meet Lincoln at the station nearest the town where he was to speak and take him in a carriage. When within 2 or 3 miles of the town, they would be met by a procession of citizens with banners and music. Then there was a speech of greeting and welcome, and the woman on the entertainment committee presented Lincoln with flowers, and sometimes, although not to his liking, they hung a garland around his neck. These 7 joint debates extended over a period of many weeks. It was very hard upon the debaters, for almost every day of the time they spoke publicly at least once. Each of them, in fact, made not less than 100 speeches during this remarkable campaign. Douglas spent lavishly, as he could afford to do, and the campaign cost him something like $80,000. Lincoln had to spend carefully, but the expenses of his campaign footed up to nearly $1,000, an insignificant sum compared with Douglas's, but yet much more than he was able to pay. "I'm absolutely without money," declared Lincoln at the time, "even for household expenses." You see, it meant much for him that during all these weeks he had not only to make what was for him a heavy outlay of money, but he had earned nothing, or next to nothing, by his law practice. The election for the Senate took place in early autumn. Lincoln received a majority of 5,000 on the popular vote, but the legislature gave Douglas a majority of 8, and therefore elected him to the United States Senate. Although it was a victory for the little giant, as Douglas was called, the debates accomplished the great purpose which Lincoln had in mind. They made clear to the people the issues involved in the slavery question. They aroused public sentiment. They developed public opinion not only in the state of Illinois, but throughout the Union. For newspaper reporters came from as far away as New York, and the reports of these speeches were read everywhere throughout the country. Still more, they drove the South to reject all compromises and insist upon an out-and-out slavery man for president. Certain it is that they gave Lincoln a prominence outside of his own state that he never had had before. Before the debates began, his friends were fearful. Some of them believed that he was putting his head into the lion's mouth and ending his political life. But such was not the case, for although Douglas became United States Senator, Lincoln had given such striking evidence of his breadth, vision, and true statesmanship that 2 years later he became the choice of the Republican Party for President of the United States. But this was a long look into the future, and he could not foresee that outcome. Now his political horizon loomed dark. Still, courage did not forsake him. While he was walking home in the gloom and darkness of that rainy election night, after he had heard of his defeat for the senatorship, he slipped into the muddy street and came near falling to the ground. But on recovering his balance, he said to himself, as he thought sadly on the news of his defeat, "It is a slip, but not a fall." For 4 long years he had struggled manfully to convince the people that slavery was wrong and should not be extended into new states, and to him it appeared that in this great cause he was making but little progress. Yet courage and hope and faith never failed him. The result is not doubtful, he told his friends. We shall not fail if we stand firm. We shall not fail. Wise counsels may accelerate or mistakes delay it, but sooner or later, the victory is sure to come. And so it proved. The present outcome was not final. The day of success was merely postponed.